The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Today on Quick Slants the Podcast, early training camp impressions, who's up, who's down, who's surprised, and who is not really even showing up. Everything related to the big three, Gronk, Brady, Belichick, and everybody down through the roster. We're going to hit it all today on Quick Slants the Podcast.
Quick Slants the Podcast is presented by Nissan. It's what you've been waiting for, friends. Big model year-end savings. Get to the bottom line model year-end event and save big on the last of Nissan's 2018s before they're gone. Shop ChooseNissan.com today. That's ChooseNissan.com.
Hey, what's up, everybody? We are right now on Tuesday, which is an off day in the Patriots training camp world. We have seen them Thursday and Friday with no pads, Saturday and Sunday with pads. Those were run-heavy football days. Phil Perry and myself are here to bring you our impressions for the next, oh, I would say 28 and a half minutes on what we've seen so far. And Phil, just hit it up quick. Let's dive into it. Some of the surprises, I think one of the storylines that overarches everything is so many of the good first impressions being made are being made by, well, of course, the first impressions. So many of the impactful impressions being made are by guys who just showed up.
I agree. And so first one that comes to mind for me is somebody like Cordarrelle Patterson. That's a guy, when he came in, when he signed with the Patriots, I talked to people who said the same things. Listen, don't expect this guy to be an offensive maven when he gets to New England. He'll be a special team stud for sure. Kickoffs, punts, punt return, kick return. He could probably do all of that. But as a receiver, might not be the best fit in this offense. And so far, we've seen him develop at least a little bit of a rapport with Tom Brady. He's made some acrobatic catches down the field. He's big. He's fast. And if they can figure out a way to get him in space and use him in this offense, he could be a threat.
And Patterson had a great quote when we spoke to him earlier this week. He's a pretty personable guy. He said, you can get with Tom Brady and figure out where he wants you to be, or you can decide not to. And if you decide not to, you can pretty much kiss your chances of seeing the ball goodbye. I paraphrase, but that's the upshot of it. Additionally, I would say, too, Trent Brown. Now, Patterson, when we see the lights go up and he is in competitive situations, it might go down a little bit. Maybe he's getting a little extra attention from Brady because of the need to make an impression and to create some chemistry. But I think Trent Brown actually might outstrip Patterson in terms of initial impressiveness.
And importance. I mean, this is the guy whose shoulders the fate of the franchise may rest in 2018, which sounds incredible, but it might be true. He's battling for that left tackle job with, we think, Isaiah Wynn, but he appears to have a stranglehold on the first team reps, at least through five practices at training camp. And he's handled them very, very well. To me, what's been most impressive about Brown has been how he's moved, especially with the pads on. I would say over the weekend, the Saturday and Sunday practices, you put those pads on, it's hot out there. Typically, you see the overall speed of the practice maybe dialed back a little bit, even if the intensity ratchets up. But for Trent Brown, you saw him getting out into space on screen plays. You saw him getting out wide on stretch runs. And those are the kinds of things that I thought were really underrated about Nate Solder's game. He was an athlete. He was a basketball player. Yep. He's a former tight end playing tackle.
Could track people down the field, too.
He really could. He could seek and destroy cornerbacks and safeties, which is hard for guys that are 6'8", 300-plus pounds. Trent Brown is 6'8", 350-plus pounds. He's listed at 380, and he's doing some of those things that we saw Nate Solder do. Now, can he do them consistently? Is he that kind of special athlete? Is he a Trent Williams or a Tyrone Smith from Dallas? I don't know. He's still got a long way to go, but I think there's a lot of potential there.
One interesting thing about Trent Brown is Von Miller said, after facing him first said that he's one of the top five right tackles in the league, circled back someone, I remember reading clips on Brown. Von Miller later circled back and said he's actually one of the best tackles in the league, regardless, right or left side. So this is a player who the Patriots got for a song, but he had started 16 games a couple years ago. Initially a seventh-round pick, the Patriots got him for a fifth. And, of course, you got him from San Francisco.
Got him for a third.
Excuse me, a
yep.
third.
Still a good deal.
Still a good deal. And, you know, when you look at the Patriots and their deal-making over the course of time, if you have sent just months earlier, specifically gift-wrapped, the Adonis, the Venus de Milo of quarterbacks, showed up as a statue on Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch's doorstep. What that does is, I'm not saying the Patriots traded Jimmy there so that they could fleece them for the next 10 years, but they've made a team that owes them. And I think in Trent Brown, you know, if he was a bit part or a spare part that they might have wanted to keep in the shed out there in San Francisco, and Bill Belichick said, can I have that? I need that thing that you have, that Brown. Could I have him?
Yeah, the big one. Yeah.
Hard to say no. Wouldn't you think?
That's a great point. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but when you put it that way, and the Patriots having a need, and it's draft weekend, and Trent Brown, according to a couple people I spoke to, showed up much closer to 400 bills than 365 or 370 or whatever they wanted him at, and all of those pieces kind of fall in place, and all of a sudden you're Kyle Shanahan, you get another call from Bill saying, hey, how about Brown for a third?
Or maybe Kyle Shanahan said, you know what, Will Lynch, this guy just showed up looking like the Goodyear blimp, okay?
Right.
We're going to have to tie ropes to him to keep him down on the ground during camp. So let's get rid of him. What do you think we can get rid of him for? I don't know. They just lost Solder out there. See if Bill wants him.
And then you can't do – imagine if they had traded a second for him. Like, imagine if the Patriots knew he was a legit left tackle. They knew he'd be able to come in. He'd work out. That's worth a second-round pick. But could you imagine the optics if they had traded that second-rounder, essentially, that they got for Garoppolo back to San Francisco for Brown?
But the deal made.
But
Bill has said time and again, deal making is about relationships, and you don't pick up the phone, especially during draft weekend, unless you know that the guy on the other end is someone with whom you're going to be able to do business. Mm-hmm. So,
not going to waste your time. Right?
Exactly. Skip on down, Danny Shelton, another guy who. Phil, what are your impressions of where he's been deployed so far, just in these first few camps?
He's been with the first group, and he's been on the nose. We've seen both 3-4 and 4-3 looks. I would say still more 4-3 than 3-4 from the Patriots defense through camp thus far, but you've seen him next to Lawrence Guy quite a bit. You have seen him occasionally next to Malcolm Brown, but you've seen him in all sorts of different situations, and he told us after the night practice inside Gillette Stadium, hey, if I could play on third down too, I would love to do it. That's what football's all about to me. I want to get after the quarterback. The Patriots typically don't like their big 350-pound tackles out there in obvious passing situations, but maybe he can do it. He did it in college. I wouldn't hold out hope if I'm a Patriots fan that you're going to see Danny Shelton rack up between, you know, 5 and 8 sacks this year. But at the very least, he's going to be a powerful and athletic guy at the point of attack against the run.
And if he could be a pocket collapser and do damage up the middle, and if the Patriots are going to be more aggressive, which we will get to later in this podcast, comments made by Dont'a Hightower, Daron Harmon, and to the contrary by Devin McCourty. We'll get into that as well. But
Mr. Contrary.
Another defensive player I want to talk about in his first go-round is not an acquisition by trade or signing. It's Duke Dawson. Phil. He's been a defensive back playing in the slot and running with the ones.
I like the Duke. He's been running with the
he
ones.
He doesn't look like he's lost out there to me. There's not a lot of post-snap conversation or pre-snap conversation, again, early on, but it's not a lot of dipshit. You're supposed to be over here.
And that is a keen observation that you make, because when you play inside, when you play in the slot, whether you are that slot corner, that star position, as they call it in New England, or you're a box safety, the communication part of it is a big part of your job, because you have to be reading your keys, run versus pass. You have to be aware of what the offensive line is doing on the other side. You have to be aware of, obviously, what the receivers are doing. And he hasn't looked lost yet. Now, there's still time.
Sure.
We're only five practices
in. It's going to get
a
little more complex.
But to see him in the slot with Stephon Gilmore on the outside on one side, Eric Rowe on the outside on the other, Devin McCourty and Patrick Chung, and that's your secondary, that's four pretty experienced guys with a guy who just got here. And to not notice him as saying, boy, he looks out of place, I would say is a good sign for Duke Tossin.
Too, if you think of the guys who are on PUP right now, Jonathan Jones and Cyrus Jones, two very different kinds of players in that Jonathan Jones is kind of a little whippet guy. You'd like to see him on a T.Y. Hilton kind of receiver. Mm-hmm. Cyrus Jones, I don't know what he can do defensively yet. I know he's got ridiculous ball skills. I know that he can has great athleticism, but he just hasn't shown out yet as a second-round pick from 2016. So we'll see if Duke Dawson continues to run with the ones when they come back. Is there anybody else that you want to highlight as eye-openers?
I would say Sony Michel, the fact that he has gotten as much one-on-one tutorial time as he has on the field has been notable to me. Now, has he been the most athletic running back of the group? Does he look the most comfortable of all the backs that the Patriots have? No. I would say that would be Rex Burkhead. And we're going to do a Perry's prediction later tonight on Training Camp Central, but I will give the listeners, since this podcast probably won't be out until after the show airs, but I will still give the listeners a preview. My prediction for tonight will be that Rex Burkhead will lead that group in terms of offensive snaps played. However, Sony Michel, to see him talking at length at the end of Monday night's practice with Josh McDaniels, Josh McDaniels, his hand on Michelle's shoulder, and those guys talking for about 5 minutes. For Bill Belichick to do the same before practice on Sunday and talk to Michelle for even longer, I would say 7 or 8 minutes during a special teams period. They have a lot invested in this guy, obviously, as a first-round pick. But I think they see a lot of potential, and he's another player, Tom, who I haven't noticed as lost out there. Mm-hmm. We'll see what happens when pass protection gets added into the deal, and they're using him in two-back sets, and he's got to run all kinds of different combination routes and things like that. But so far, so good for Sony Michel, I would say, outside of one fumble, which was an issue for him at times in college, and so he'll have to get that cleaned up.
Let's immediately now go to Tom Brady and his performance, what I thought was the performance of the team over the first 4 days. Going to take out that in-stadium practice because I think that's an outlier. It was a glorified walkthrough.
Very laid back.
The kind of first two kind of were as well. But I don't want to say listless would be the description I would use for the first couple of padded practices, but I would say unenthusiastic. And, you know, you could call it businesslike if you wanted to put a nice spin on it, or you could call it blah. I just didn't think there was a lot of intensity, enthusiasm. Hey, it's football season and we're football players playing football and making football plays. It was none of that. And, you know, I just wonder as Brady comes back after a weird offseason and Matt Patricia someplace else and Brian Flores has taken on a bigger role and, you know, Brady and Gronk come back and reassert themselves after having been away. And you have quieter leaders on defense anyway, with McCourty and Hightower and Chung. And offensively, you've got Edelman facing a 4-game suspension as he comes back from an injury. And Amendola's not there. Stephon Gilmore might be your best defensive player early in the, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And he wouldn't say poop if he had a mouthful. It just doesn't seem like it's a high-intensity whoop-it-up camp yet.
Saturday, definitely. I saw a smidge of that at the end of Sunday's practice from the defense. And this kind of gets to one of my overall takes from the first 5 days, which is that the defense is certainly far and away ahead of the offense. And that's not a huge surprise. We say that it feels like about this time every year. But the defense did show a little bit of that, especially after goal line. They dominated the goal line drill. You saw guys jumping up, doing the side bump, hooting and hollering.
Mm-hmm.
Offensively, when we're accustomed to seeing Tom Brady heard after situations both good and bad, he's been pretty quiet outside of one little flare-up where he was just frustrated himself because he overshot Chris Hogan and took a football and spiked it into the ground. Rob Gronkowski, somebody who was high-stepping up and down the field in the spring and spiking it all over the place, trying to throw footballs inside Gillette Stadium after scoring touchdowns, he has been very quiet. You know, Gronk's been fine playing wise, but you just haven't seen him emote
right
in that way that you're talking about, that you're looking for.
And I think that's a necessary part of these practices. You saw it actually on Monday night in the stadium. You know, Isaiah Wynn pulled in a punt, and I think that the crowd and the contained energy within the game fields and games, you know, and the stadium atmosphere changed the tenor a little bit. maybe that serves as a spur for it, but you just become accustomed over the years, and I've been doing it for a while now, and, you know, you're just used to a different level of noise. And the noise will come right now during the plays and in the immediate aftermath, but afterwards it's quiet, and it's just, I'm not seeing the same speed moving from station to station. You folks can go down there, take a look, tell me if my observations mesh with yours or not.
I would say offensively, everything kind of flows off Brady and Gronk, right? So let's take those two separately. Why do you think, and you made a point about this last night on TV, why do you think with Brady he has been that way?
I think that him being the leader that he is, he probably deep in the recesses of his mind understands that, look, these guys have been here all the way through. I'm not going to come in here and smash through the saloon doors and say, you know, sheriff's in town. You know, everybody put your beers down and listen to me. I think that he's going to, especially if he's not playing at an extreme level, he has to, at this point, if Jordan Matthews runs at the wrong depth and ends up making reception out of bounds, he can't tear him a new one. He has to explain it to him, you know, like, better off if you're at this point.
That's going
to be
because
he didn't talk about it in June.
More of an arm around the shoulder kind of
didn't talk
situation.
About it in May at passing camp. Mm-hmm. So this is where he's probably going to have a little bit of a tenor that's he has to work up to that. Gronk. That's a theory. That's all it is. It's a theory.
I think it's
and
a good
that
I
just don't think that he would walk in and even at 41 or maybe at 41 he has grown past the point where, as we saw him, I remember in Atlanta in 2010, he threw an incompletion. He screamed "fuck" so loud on their practice field in Flowery Branch that it absolutely echoed around and off the trees. And, you know, you have all manner of Atlanta Falcons fans, Patriots fans, media, and just that intensity level has been a constant during camp, and I've not seen it yet except for that one instance.
With Rob Gronkowski, I wonder if his change in emotion or his dialing back of emotion from spring to summer relates at all to his contract. And we don't want to look too deeply into this, but he was distinctly, or he took a distinctly different approach in terms of discussing the contract when asked about it, spring versus summer. In the spring, he said, of course, who wouldn't love a new contract? Yeah, I'm trying to work on it. Summertime comes around. He still doesn't have a deal, Tom. And he's asked about it again, and he says, you know what, we're going to keep all that internal. I think right now he's trying to do everything he can behind the scenes, on the field, at the podium, to make sure that he doesn't gum up any of the machinery behind the scenes that would at some point result in a new deal for him.
Because I think our reflexive, or a lot of the media's reflexive reaction is to observe Gronk, and if he takes a knee and takes his helmet off and misses a rep because he's playing with the ear pads, he's probably pissed about his contract right there.
Right.
But I think you have to look at, okay, that 11-second instance or Brady's 5-second instance of throwing the ball or even his 90 minutes on the practice field in front of us still doesn't amount to more than 10% of his day spent with his teammates. So that's why I say 5 practices, we observe, we relay, but we try not to make sweeping conclusions.
Right.
Just here's what we've seen so far.
And I should say, you know, just because he's not high-stepping up and down the field, or if he was, say he was. Say he was doing everything he was doing in the spring.
That doesn't mean the contract's about to come either.
Bill Belichick isn't not giving him a contract because of those sorts of things. I just think he probably has come to the realization, hey, I got to be as businesslike as possible all the way around.
Yeah, you know what? Especially, and again, too, maybe that relates to him in the same respect I was talking about Brady. Okay, oh, look at Mr. Energy here. No wonder he's so rested. He was floating around in a seahorse, you know, tube while we were lifting.
Right.
And then doing motocross press conferences and screwing out of here. So maybe he's measuring the way he steps as well. We're going to have Mike Lombardi on in just a minute or two to talk about his new book, about his life in and around the NFL. So we're going to hit that in just a minute. But my last observation has to be about a conversation I had with Dante Hightower and then with Daron Harmon about aggressiveness defensively and the learning curve. Harmon said that the team has been looking for new ways to create aggressiveness that will create pressure on offenses. And then Dante Hightower talked about playing fast, learning more simplified schemes defensively, and attacking. And I thought that both of those, regardless of who the coordinators are and were, speak to an interest in making the offense speed up, because I think the Patriots have been at a point where they've been extremely reactionary defensively. And it's getting to a point where they're being dictated to on a regular basis. And it's been going on for a couple of years. You know, they've got plenty of wins in there, but I think there's also a lot of those wins are credited to, you know, the quarterback, who you just say, can you please bail us out and make sure you score 32 here today?
Well, players want to play fast, right? They want to be aggressive, especially in big situations. Dante Hightower wants to be able to try to get after the quarterback in the Super Bowl late in the game and force a game-changing play. Those are all things that get guys excited. And so when you have a changing coordinator, you have somebody who played the game at a very high level. You know, no knock against RPI, where Matt Patricia played his college ball, but Brian Flores played at BC. And it's a little bit different, I think. And I think Flores might understand, hey, we're not all rocket scientists here. We're going to give these guys a couple of things to think about. Players like Devin McCourty or Dante Hightower, maybe we give them a little bit more and they can communicate to the rest of the body that is the Patriots defense. If we can play a little bit faster, if we can play a little bit more aggressive, that's going to be better for us in the long term. And I think we're hearing Patriots players convey their excitement at the prospects of doing that. We'll see if it actually happens.
Yeah, Christian Sam and Juwan Bentley, both rookies drafted this year in the latter rounds, were singled out by Hightower as being examples of young guys who just came in and are learning at a fast pace and moving forward. So we're going to watch that throughout camp. You're not going to see a million blitzes. You might not see a lot of flying around, but we will see formations. We will see scheming to a degree, 4-3-3-4. So we'll keep an eye on that. As I said, Mike Lombardi coming up. Right now, we're just going to talk about his book and going to try and get him on the record about one of the Hall of Fame inductees for this weekend.
Ooh.
All right, with me now, Mike Lombardi, who next month will have a book coming out called Gridiron Genius, 288 pages detailing his time as an executive in the NFL. And as you know, he spent time with the Patriots, of course, under Bill Belichick, but he originally was with Bill Walsh and the 49ers and also worked underneath Al Davis and the Oakland Raiders. So when we talk about the great dynasties in NFL history and the great franchises in NFL history, we would talk about those three certainly as being the standard bearers. Mike, how you doing, my friend?
I am great, Tom. Thank you. I'm glad to be here. So it's been a great run, I can tell you that.
I'll tell you, and it continues now. You're at the Ringer, and we've had you on as a guest. So your information, especially as it pertains to the Patriots, is always invaluable. How did the idea germinate to do a book?
Well, you know, I've always wanted to write. When my last year at the Raiders, when I kind of saw the handwriting on the wall when Art Shelwood became the head coach, I kind of felt like, you know, this is probably not going to work out for me much longer. And in the NFL, when you reach a certain level, it's hard to stay employed because they don't want to hire you because they're afraid they're going to take your job, or there's so much politics. So I took a writing class in San Francisco. There were 15 of us, 14 females. I was the only male.
Mm-hmm.
I might not have been the toughest guy in the class, but I was there. And I took a writing class. Always wanted to write. I love writers. If you came in my home, I have more autographed books, and I have no jerseys, but I have a lot of autographed books from writers. So, you know, and I've always wanted to write this book in my head. It was called The Bill of Rights, which was about Bill Belichick and Bill Walsh, how similar they are in terms of how they handle things. And even though in terms of their style, they're not similar, but their substance is very similar. So that's always been my motive operandi. I wanted to write this Bill of Rights book, but unfortunately, I wanted to incorporate Al in it, and the publisher thought that that wouldn't be a way to get people more engaged. So they came up with the title that we came up with.
Yeah. No, it's interesting too, because you mentioned the Bill Walsh, Bill Belichick parallels. And I've seen so many parallels in, you know, I'm sure you've read Three Bricks Shy of a Load. The Chuck Knoll, Bill Belichick comparison is certainly there. But Paul Brown was, of course, linked to Bill Walsh, and Bill Belichick goes back to Paul Brown himself. So are all those threads in your mind really overlapping and interwoven?
No doubt. I mean, and Paul Brown's in the book, too. I mean, Paul Brown has a quote back in 1955 where he talks about quarterbacks, you know, are going to have to learn how to play a different style and run around because the defensive linemen are way too fast now. But he saw the game for what it was becoming, and I thought that was ingenious. And Bill, used to hold a meeting with every staff department before training camp started. It was very Paul Brownish. In fact, I was talking to Mike Brown the other day, and I sent him a copy of the book, and I just said, Paul, I said, Mike, your dad's in a lot of these pages, even though his name might not be on them. And I have great respect for Paul and for Mike and the entire Brown family. So, yeah, I think there's no doubt there's an overlap. I mean, when you hear Bill Walsh talk and you hear Bill Belichick approach things and how they make decisions, it's eerily similar.
How many anecdotes are you able to share in this book, especially really relative to the Patriots, that are going to open our eyes and give us more insight into how things are done and how decisions are arrived at?
Well, I think, look, you know, what I try to do is portray Belichick that he is in terms of a great leader, that he could really go in and run any Fortune 500 company and be successful. His area of expertise happens to be football, but his decision-making expertise happens to be everywhere. So, you know, that's what I try to do. One of the chapters that I wrote is basically the week of the Baltimore game, where I take the reader inside the week of our preparation for the Baltimore game, how we prepared for that game coming off a great season.
The divisional playoff?
The divisional playoff game. We're 12-4. We had the bye week. You know, we got ready. We got down by 14 points, came back, got down by 14 again and came back. And all the things that went into that and the genius behind how he prepared the team. And I think one of the things that Bill does a remarkable job with, and I wish he would allow it taped more. And I think maybe as he gets older, he might. But he has a Saturday night staff meeting with the coaches where he goes over the game in detail. And that meeting is probably the most unique meeting I've ever been a part of. One time when I was with the Browns, Nick Saban and I used to sit next to each other at every Saturday meeting. And we were getting ready to play the Eagles. And the Eagles were 6-2 and the Cleveland Browns were 6-2 at the time. So it was a big game. We're playing at Veterans Stadium. And Bill comes in, and as he always does, he starts to address the staff and talks about the game the next day and what's going to happen and what he wants done and how he wants the game coached and how he wants the players handled. And he starts to tell us how he thinks the game's going to be over with by the first quarter because we're going to dominate the game and we're going to kick them out of the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick and I left the meeting, and we thought, what is he smoking? I mean, there's something in this cheesesteak here. There's just no way, you know? And naturally, he was right, and that's the way the game went. I mean, look, just take the Super Bowl 51 when they beat Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, here he is. He's preparing for the team, and he knows that he's going to need two-point plays because he's afraid that if he gets up by 18, he may need to make it 20, or if he gets up by 19. So he prepared himself to have a lot of two-point plays. And that didn't really work out for him, but it did, because when he got down by 8-16, mm-hmm. he needed those two-point plays to come back. It's just that insight into his preparation that makes him so damn unique and so different. I mean, we are looking at an age in the NFL where there's no longer head coaches. They're subcontractors, guys that basically call plays. Bill is one of the last true head coaches in the NFL.
With the overarching authority to be a CEO as opposed to
Vice
President of Sideline.
I mean, this is no disrespect to anybody, but he'll come in and tell the coordinators this is what he wants to do, this is how he sees the game. I mean, and this is what he wants run, and that's, to me, what it needs to be. The NFL is really it's a paramilitary organization where it works from the top down. It's mm-hmm. not the Dave Clark Five where everybody has a vote. And so I admire that about Bill, and he does it with unbelievable foresight.
You talk about the Saturday meeting and prior to 51. I wonder what it would have been like prior to Super Bowl 52, because as many players have acknowledged, they knew going into the week that Malcolm Butler wasn't going to start. But by the end of that meeting, I would imagine that Matt Patricia, Josh Boyer understood that, okay, this player might not play at all.
Right. Yeah, I think they prepared for it during the week. I mean, certainly, you know, and I don't know what happened. I've not been privy to that information or what caused Malcolm to not play. But I think people focus too much on that specifically. I think that game was lost really in a couple areas. You know, Brandon Cooks, if he goes right or if he goes left instead of hurdling, that could have won the game. Mm-hmm. Missing field goals hurt them, missing the extra point. And really, I think if you want to second guess anything that happened in that game, go back to when the Patriots finally took the lead and the Eagles got the ball back. The Eagles were able to run 7 minutes off that clock, and that gave their defense time to rest. The Eagles' defense never really played more than 26 minutes mm-hmm. during the season. Whenever they played 30 minutes, they lost. And so they needed to get that play count up. And when they gave them those 7 minutes, it really affected the game because it rested their defense. that was a time to go all out blitz and either make a play or not make a play. And I think those are one of the things that they'll always regret more than the Malcolm Butler decision.
And play count obviously figured in absurdly in Super Bowl 51. And that's part of the reason they just ran so many plays. The Patriots offense did in the first half, even though they were behind. But there was a domino effect to Butler not being in there, because now all of a sudden you have Chung is in a different spot, which brings Richards into Chung's spot. And Jordan Richards is not the player that Chung is, nor is Chung out of position the same guy Butler would be.
No doubt. I mean, so obviously there's something that happened there that I'm not privy to. But I think we tend to get caught on one instance of a game is my only point. But I'm sure that Saturday night meeting, everybody was well aware of what was going to happen on Sunday.
One thing
you got to know about Belichick, nothing is done by the seat of his pants. I mean, Belichick is truly the great carpenter. He measures twice, cuts once.
And that's why we still won't understand why he threw out one of the cellar windows when a rainstorm was coming. Be that as it may, I want to ask you about, as Randy Moss nears his Hall of Fame induction, and we look at him obviously as a Minnesota Viking if they wore hats into the Hall of Fame, but also as a Patriot, and he spent the time with the Raiders. What was your recollection of him as a player prior to him being traded here by you to the Patriots?
I think he was the most incredible player that I've ever witnessed on a field. His hands were unbelievable. His speed was something I've never really seen before. And Randy was always misunderstood as a player because he wasn't very media friendly, so he didn't have a great media perception. But the reality of Randy, once you get past the West Virginia twang, was he was a really smart player. And he was really smart about life and about football. And when Randy didn't respect you, and I think this is really important for coaches to understand, coaches are all about knowledge. If players respect your knowledge, they'll listen to you, whether you're 18 or 80. But if they don't respect your knowledge, you lose them. And I think what happened with Randy, when Norv got fired and the staff was changed over to Tom Walsh's offense, Art Schell as the head coach, he just lost a lot of respect for that situation, and that manifested itself into more problems. And look, I got fired because I told Bill Belichick, this is a true story. I told Bill Belichick that he could still run, and Al got mad at me because they told him. Now, I still can't figure out why telling him that he could still run when Al wanted to trade him, I got fired, but that might require me writing a whole other book.
Well, I mean, I remember the overhead projector. I remember the press conference that Al held.
And for the record, I didn't trade. Al did that deal himself because Art Schell didn't want it. I mean, Lane Kiffin wanted no parts of coaching Randy Moss, and Randy wanted no parts of staying there. You know, he just felt like the program went to hell. But when we had Randy this first year in Oakland and his first seven games before he got hurt, he was the most dominant player on the field.
Was that Andrew Walter throwing to him at that point?
Well, that year that he left in 06, well, in 06 it was Andrew Walter, when he was healthy. And it was Andrew Walter, it was Tony Banks, it was a collection of just bad. I mean, we were a bad team.
All right. Hey, well, this is going to be a great book. And as always, a friend of ours, appreciate you coming on today. And we will absolutely, once we've had a chance and the book is released, that's still a month and a half away, September 18th, Gridiron Genius will come out. And we'll probably want to get to be on part of that media tour to circle back with you. So I appreciate it very much, Mike.
Thanks, Tom. Anytime.
All right.